voices of veterans who, in the darkest of circumstances, have found their spiritual light. This is Faith on the Front Lines, a special presentation by Mark Juke and KSL News Radio 102.7 FM and 1160 AM.
Landing operations in the Philippines.
One of the most well-known photos of World War II shows a triumphant General Douglas MacArthur walking back onto the beach on the Philippines, fulfilling his promise that he would return. In the background of that photo, standing on a landing craft, was a young Hal Goldie.
Our job was to release the prisoners of war.
By that time, Goldie, who had served in the 46th Infantry Division, had become an assistant to a chaplain's assistant in General MacArthur's staff. Goldie was born in New York and raised a Lutheran.
I made my confirmation in the church, and I took it very seriously that God put you on this earth for His pleasure. That struck me. How do I please God? Is it because we believe we were created in His image? Therefore, every living person has been created by God.
As a soldier, his unit saw limited combat. He says they were largely an occupational force, coming in after others had secured territory. One day early on, he witnessed a fellow soldier shoot an already dead enemy soldier.
I said to God, you know, I'd rather be killed than killed.
Goldie says the soldier, though, went on to utter racial slurs against not only the Japanese, but the Germans and the Jews.
And I said, hold on. Do you go to church? I said, of course I go to church. I said, guess what? Jesus Christ was a Jew. He said, well, he's the only Jew that's okay. I said, no, you're wrong there. The Jewish people are the apple of God's eye, if you know anything about your Bible. And right then I had a test of, this is an enemy. I have to love him.
Goldie wrote a letter home about the exchange, one that he says never got there. He figures military censors held on to it, and that's possibly why he was made a chaplain's aide. Goldie, for one, believes God can exist in the worst of circumstances.
Because you know it in your heart. You know He's present. He cares about every one of us. And that's when he said, love your enemy. And I thought, how can you love somebody that's your enemy? And I look back and say, because he was created in the image of God just like you were. You were, too.
Though he wasn't officially a chaplain, the others began calling him Chappie. He helped organize religious services and says prayer was a constant comfort.
It was important to me on a personal basis when I prayed to God without anybody else knowing about it. And that was every night. And, of course, We would lead them in prayers at the meetings. I was singing. I had a quartet, and I was a second tenor, and we had a first tenor. And that boy was killed with a kamikaze. And Kenny, his name was Kenny. I can still remember that. Kenny was down in the hold. He hadn't been released yet to come ashore, and I think he drowned. And I prayed for Kenny. Well, I knew I thanked God for Kenny being one of the four of the quartet that I organized.
Outside of the services, Goldie counseled soldiers, some of whom were seeking God.
Desperately. Where is God? I said, He's right here. If He's in your heart, He doesn't stand there looking at you. He's within you. And then and they say, well, I don't feel that. And I said, well, I do. Believe me, He's here. Does that mean I'm not going to die? No. You may die. I may die. Tomorrow, all of us may be dead. But God is with us. That's what my firm belief was. And is today.
Still to come, the story of a soldier who fought his way through Europe, then returned months later to serve as a missionary, when Faith on the Front Lines continues.
You're listening to Faith on the Front Lines on KSL News Radio.
These are the ribbons and so forth up there with four battle stars.
During his military service in the war, Al Fisher knew combat.
In battle, you're humble. You're mean, but you're humble. I don't know if you can quite grasp that or not, but you're humble, recognizing that, you really don't have a lot of control over what's going to take place, but you're mean so that you can control it as much as you can.
Fisher served in the Army in the 94th Infantry Division.
We were out there in front. Pioneer means you're out in front to make it safe for other people who come. And the miracle for me is that I made it. I think that one of the things that towards the end of the war that bothered me was that I've gone this far, and I don't want to be killed the last day of the war.
Born and raised in Utah, Fisher, a Latter-day Saint, kept with him two books during his military service, pocket versions of the Book of Mormon and of the Principles of the Gospel.
I kept both of them right next to my body the whole time, so I suppose I can't say that every day I woke up and say, hey, these two, these books are that significant that they became a part of who I was.
Fisher fought from the Ardennes, site of the Battle of the Bulge, into Central Europe. He was asked about how his faith impacted his service.
I can't answer that because I don't know what it would have been like without it. I know that with it, I knew that the purpose of this life, I knew that what I was thoroughly convinced that what I was doing was right. Even though we were taking lives, it was for a cause that was just. It had to be done.
In 2 years of combat, he never met in any kind of gathering with fellow Latter-day Saints.
I would much prefer to have had some camaraderie with members of the church, but I got used to it. It became, okay, here I am. Most of the LDS went to the Pacific Theater. They were from the Western U.S. They went to the Pacific Theater where they met in organized ways. I don't know of another LDS. For the total time from the time I left the States till the time I got back.
Fisher believes, though, there was divine help involved.
I think there was divine help every day. You know, you talk about miracles, I think that every day was a miracle. Without divine help, as I look at the total war, the outcome could have been different.
During the Battle of the Bulge, for example, fog initially hid German tank movements during their fierce offensive. But snow moved in, and fog would sometimes lift quickly.
When the weather cleared up, there was snow on the ground, and you could see where the German tanks had gone into the forest. So you could see where they actually were. So, rather than being camouflaged and hidden, it was like shooting ducks in a barrel there, or fish in a barrel for a while.
Eventually, clear weather allowed American air power to come in.
Oh, what a relief when it cleared up and we finally saw some American planes up there.
Later, Fisher and his unit got a taste of German air power in the form of emerging technology.
We always had machine guns ready for an air attack, even though we had air support superiority at that time. And wham! With no warning whatsoever, we had been hit. And we had no idea what had hit us. And then and after it had gone by, then we heard the roar. And we didn't know what the roar was. Well, it was a jet.
Earlier in the war, those planes could have been devastating.
If they had come earlier, and the Germans had been working on heavy water and nuclear weapons too, if they had gotten them, could have turned it around. They didn't. We were able to take that out. The weather, the timing of when they got things and when we got things, it was a miracle. There were one miracle after another.
On May 8, 1945, nearly a year after the invasion at Normandy, the war in Europe ended.
I returned home in the fall of 1945, and within a week or two after I had returned, the bishop called me into his office and says, I'm going to call you on a mission. And I said, no, you're not. Let's face it, I'd been in the Army at 17. I'd had no social life whatsoever. And now, and almost my entire 19th year, had been in combat. And I wanted to come home and unpack my duffel bag and spend a little bit of time first. But after about a year, I was ready to go.
He was called to the Netherlands.
I was 20. I had a lot of combat. I was not a little kid, and many of my missionaries were too. So we did proselyting, but a lot of what we did was in leadership. I was branch president in Arnhem, in Leiden, in various other areas. I was actually a Relief Society president at one time.
One of his duties was to help organize a food donation from the saints in the Netherlands for people in Germany. They grew potatoes and bought barrels of fish for them. During the German occupation only a few years earlier, people in Holland had been poorly treated.
They didn't call them just Germans. They called them bad names. But within the church, that feeling of brotherhood was there.
Being a missionary was a different experience for Fisher.
In many ways, it was more challenging because as a soldier, we could win a victory and take the territory and we could hold it. But going as a missionary, you can go in and try to convert people, and you don't know if you can make it or if you can hold it after you do.
But it was that freedom of choice, agency, that the Allies had tried to defend during the war.
Agency is more important than just freedom, because agency can be violated. And agency, the opportunity to violate, that's what we were fighting for, to use it right or wrong. And we were fighting, hoping that it would be used right.
Decades later, Fisher and his wife would return to Belgium and would be there during the 50th anniversary of the Battle of the Bulge.
I told the missionaries there, we were older, I was younger, and said, hey, look, what you're doing is much more important than what I did. Because what I did, as we look at the world now, Omar Bradley, I'm quite sure it was Omar Bradley, said after the war, we are a culture of atomic giants and ethical infants. And by the time we'd returned in 1993 to Belgium, obviously a lot of the agency for which we were fighting during World War II had been used improperly. And there were things that, so I said, look, you army of young people out there letting people know how you should live and converting them so that they will live that way, is more important because it is more lasting, deeper, more lasting here and for eternity than what I did as a military during the Battle of the Bulge.
After his mission, Fisher spent time at the CIA and as an officer in naval intelligence. He also worked and taught at the departments of geography, both at Utah and at BYU. Still to come, from World War II to Korea, Vietnam, and beyond, and the story of a Utahn who spent 5.5 years at the infamous Hanoi Hilton, when faith on the front lines continued.
This is Faith on the Front Lines, the voices of veterans who found their spiritual light, even in the darkest of hours.
From World War II to Korea, then to Vietnam and beyond, political lines became less clear as to why Americans were involved in some conflicts, but soldiers, sailors, airmen, and Marines still served in with valor and still found connections with their faith in the worst of times. They were people like Jay Hess.
I was shot down really close to the China border and moved into Hanoi, and they had an old French prison there that they used as a central location for interrogation of POWs. We called it Hanoi Hilton.
The infamous Hanoi Hilton, where hundreds of prisoners were kept. Hess would spend 5.5 years there, undergoing interrogation, poor living conditions, and torture. After spending 2 months in isolation, he eventually would be placed into a darkened cell with others.
When I got my three other cellmates, the first Sunday, you were waking up in the morning, and you know you hurt. And you're just kind of trying to come alive. And my Navy roommate, cellmate, said, "You know, on Sundays I've heard a bump on the wall. I think it's church call." And I never had any experience like that, but I was so happy that he brought up that subject. I could have hugged him because I really felt a need for this kind of thought. And so we just said the Lord's Prayer together.
Another cellmate added to that idea.
My cellmate that spoke German, and his parents were immigrants, he said to some else guys, we ought to do, we ought to say the Pledge of Allegiance.
To the flag of the United
they would
States
spend
of
the rest of their time trying to exercise, trying to learn new things from each other, and Hess says there was a lot of time for prayer.
There was a lot of time for prayer. Most of the I had a Catholic cellmate that, while we were doing all this morning exercise, he was on his knees praying.
Hess's experience changed his own prayers.
There's different kinds of prayers. Our prayers are pretty casual when everything's okay. And when we have a real trial in our life, we get really serious with our prayers. And being a POW in a situation where you don't know if you're going to be alive tomorrow, you use prayer as kind of a clean up my life act. There's a lot of I wish I'd have done this different kind of stuff. And it's a cleansing feeling and a strengthening feeling that comes. You know, and it just doesn't matter who you are. It is a strengthening. It's a pep talk. It lightens a burden.
A burden he bore year after year, not knowing when or if they would be free, but relying on his faith.
You know, there's some times when you say, I can't do this by myself. This is bigger than it's overwhelming. I mean, there's so many unknowns.
Hess eventually was able to write a letter home, six lines that open with this: above all, I seek for eternal life for all of you. These are important. Temple marriage, missionary, college, press on. Of hundreds of people taken prisoner, Hess only knew of a couple of other Mormons. In one account, he remembers hearing some of them in the camp practicing a familiar hymn. Hess says one of the greatest blessings he had were his cellmates.
Yeah, you grow. I don't think I see it so much in myself as I do with the people I were with, but I kind of look at it like I saw great men in their finest hour. They were tested. We were tested to our limit. And you just have to acknowledge the growth and the different person.
In the end, Hess says his faith helped him and others triumph.
And so what we have to arm ourselves with? Well, it was faith in ourselves and faith in God, and not wanting to disappoint or let down anybody else. And we had a code of conduct, and we kind of had a sense of pride and a spirit of patriotism. And armed with those things, we kind of fought that battle and won it.
Here they come.
In March of 1973, Hess was finally freed.
You expect life to have ups and downs. You don't expect them to go so low. But if they go really low, then every little bit is nice going up. But coming home was an unbelievable high. You see people kissing the ground. Well, I didn't kiss the ground, but they gave us a chance when we come off the airplane to say something. I just said, you can't believe how good it feels to be free. Jeremiah Denton, who was the first guy to come off an airplane, he put it in perspective. He said, it has been an honor to serve the country under difficult circumstances.
We are profoundly grateful to our commander-in-chief and to our nation for this day. God bless America.
God bless America.
Israel and the Arab world went to war today for the third time in 20 years.
A few years earlier, and thousands of miles away, it was another war that unfolded over the course of days that left a dramatic impact on Jeff Einhorn.
I had earned the Jewish Scouting Award, and
earned or was given a trip to Israel by somebody in our congregation back in Michigan. And I ended up being on a border kibbutz with Syria on June 7, 1967.
Right in the middle of the Six-Day War.
And they couldn't get us out. So I spent 3.5 days on that border kibbutz.
But rather than wait in a shelter, Einhorn, who was 14 at the time, volunteered to help in defending the small Jewish communal settlement.
Because of the size of the kibbutz, they needed every able body that wanted to. And there were 40 of us in the study group, and only about 15 of us were goofy enough or crazy enough to say yes.
Of the 800 or so Israelis who died in the Six-Day War, about 200 were from those settlements. To Einhorn, who also served for the U.S. in Desert Storm, those few days underscored his identity.
And I think that experience played more on who I was, what I was, than Desert Storm did.
I have therefore directed General Norman Schwarzkopf, in conjunction with coalition forces.
Even though in Desert Storm, he was again part of history.
Historically, yes, we made some history, but it wasn't history that we could publicly talk about.
Jewish services in Saudi Arabia were prohibited, so they had to be held quietly and on the U.S. bases. Einhorn didn't think much of the historic nature of those services at the time.
The chance to go to Friday night services while I was over there was kind of a stress buster. It got me away from the unit, got me out from under, you know, the constant fear. Even though the fear was there, it didn't seem as bad because we'd travel during the day, get to the sponsoring unit, have dinner, have services. They'd put us up overnight, and then we'd travel back to the units the next morning.
His experience in the Middle East gave him a new appreciation for religious freedom.
The big difference is we do have those freedoms to practice what we preach. Women's rights are a whole lot different. The overall situation toward religion is so much different here. You know, nobody really questions if you're Mormon, Jewish, Catholic, Protestant.
You're listening to Faith on the Front Lines on KSL News Radio.
Building was lying down.
Today we've had a national tragedy.
September 11, 2001, a day that changed the world and the lives of many who had already been serving in the Guard and Reserves.
It was a family tradition. My father was in the military, and actually all of his siblings were also in the military. His sister was a WASP. So it is a traditional type of thing.
Army Master Sergeant Tammy Sower first started in the Navy Reserve, then moved over to the Army in 1996. Sower was deployed to Iraq in the fall of 2006 as part of the 300th Military Intelligence Brigade.
You know, in our pre-mob, with the five women that we had, not all of us, we were all religious. We were not of the same religion. But we felt that every day if we started with prayer, that we could, you know, confront any of the challenges that we would have for that day.
When they got to Iraq, though, they were split up.
I got a roommate that was from the Air Force, who was Christian. We didn't find that out until one night, late in December, when we really didn't know if we were going to see the next year. There was firing and mortaring and shooting, and as we were laying in bed with all of our gear on, I said, "Hey, what do you think about prayer?" And she sat up, "I'm all for it." So we began to pray even there every day, and sometimes multiple times during the day. So I found that prayer for me really equals faith, because if I don't have the faith that my prayer will be answered, then why pray?
Though her assignment never put her in a direct combat role, Sower had what she called several dangerous encounters.
We had some unexploded ordnances that came in close to us, and we were told to stay in our pods and stay with ready, wait for the alarms, don't come out. Anybody knocks on your door, don't answer.
Another incident happened during a convoy in southern Iraq. Their engine had caught fire.
And we had found out that we were in an area that had just had an improvised explosive device, the IEDs, just within that 24 hours. And so not only were we in enemy territory, we were broken down. We had to find our way back.
When they returned, they were told another army truck that had barely missed them on the road had lost its brakes.
So I really believe, even at that point, that prayer was a mighty thing. I know that the prayers of my family were answered that day in keeping us safe. Prayer's a mighty thing. It's very, very powerful for me. solidified it in my heart at that time.
And it apparently was solidified in others as well.
I have never seen so many people pray over food at every meal. Before they leave to go out on convoys, these are people that weren't necessarily religious, but yet they realized that prayer could probably keep them safe.
Years earlier, Sower had served a mission for the LDS Church to Korea.
Many of them believe in God over there, or a higher power, but this one was particularly a Christian. And he says, "Why are you always so happy? There's just something about you that's different. There's just this light about you." And I went, "I don't know." I says, I know that I believe in God." He says, "Yeah, so do I."
Sower returned from deployment in 2007, but continued to serve in the Army. Still to come, a man who found his faith during deployment and another who found his calling when Faith on the Front Lines continues.
You're listening to Faith on the Front Lines on KSL News Radio.
Staff Sergeant Andrew Blunt is with the 19th Special Forces Group at Camp Williams.
I'm a paratrooper. That's like one of the best things in the entire world.
He had grown up LDS.
I didn't have a testimony. I didn't have any faith.
But he says he reached a turning point when he was gearing up to deploy to Afghanistan.
But I called my dad up and asked him for a blessing. And when I went over there and received a blessing, I don't remember his exact words, but I remember him saying that if I would seek out the truth, that I would be protected.
Blunt says that meant a lot to him as he moved into the unknown.
A couple days after that, I started thinking about it, and it kind of dawned on me that why would I ask for a blessing if, you know, I didn't have, you know, just a little bit of faith or a little bit of knowledge of the truth that I would later find.
He also found support from others in his unit.
The Spirit can be there if you let it be there, if you're doing the right things and living the way that you need to be, regardless of what's around you.
To others who are questioning or doubting, Blunt says, make the decision to search for truth.
If you make the decision to go forward and search out that spiritual truth and search out those experiences and that knowledge, you'll find it.
At worship services at the Redeeming Life Church in Salt Lake City, you'll find Pastor Brian Catherman with his congregation.
I'm really glad that you're here. Good.
Being here, though, isn't exactly where Catherman thought he would end up.
I joined the military because I was a rebellious young man with no direction in my life.
Early on, he thought he would become an attorney.
Going into the military found a sense of discipline, but then after that I found my wife. She and I started venturing into just looking into some church stuff, and it was a couple years later that I gave my life to the Lord, and we became Christians, and sort of set us in a whole new trajectory.
That trajectory first took him to Iraq in 2003 as a staff sergeant in the 3rd Armored Cavalry Regiment.
When I got in country and reality set in, I thought, what in the world are we doing? What am I going to do here? People are trying to kill us.
His perspective and life began to change.
At night on the Syrian border, it looks like you're on the ocean. You just can't see anything, and there's just stars. And I thought, my life needs to be for something much more than this. I'm serving my country right now, but I'd really prefer to serve my God.
Combat sharpened his focus.
It felt so much more real when your life is on the line, when those that are around you are in that same boat. Some of them are worried, some of them are not. You're far from your family. Your relationship with God, at least my relationship with God, really seemed to grow profoundly.
Catherman says one of the experiences in the military that helped set him on his path was a conversation with a friend.
He looked at me at one point and said, "You know, you're going to be a pastor someday?" And I gave him an obscene gesture and said, "What do you think about that?" He said, "No, you mark my words."
Catherman returned home safely, but
when I got home and the realness of my walk with Jesus started to feel a little different, it didn't feel any less real. It just didn't feel like I was depending on Jesus so much. And that wasn't anybody's fault but my own. That's when my faith started to seem to wane. And through a short season of that, I think that actually helped me find my calling into the pastorate.
Catherman also says he came home to his wife, a different person.
God held us together well. And my wife was incredibly gracious. I mean, she really showed me Christ's love.
You can pray with them, visit with them, and talk to them.
From a pastor to a chaplain, Utah National Guard Captain Tim Clayson works with about 300 to 400 soldiers.
I'll talk to any soldier who will talk back to me. and who will engage with me regardless of what their faith group is.
But before he was a chaplain, he was a deployed soldier to Iraq. He served at Kambuka, the largest detention facility in Iraq during the troop surge there. For him, deployment was especially difficult. Just after the unit arrived in Kuwait, Clayson got an emergency message about his pregnant wife. He was allowed to return home for the birth and to spend about a week afterward.
What can prepare someone to leave one last kiss on the forehead of that baby and to hand her to her mom and then step into the unknown without faith?
Clayson says his prayers changed dramatically while he was in Iraq.
It's probably somewhat of an indictment of the way I prayed beforehand. Maybe our prayers change proportionately to how badly we feel we need God to hear us.
An experience on Christmas Day stays in his memory.
We brought in a group of detainees from the Anbar province, from Fallujah and Ramadi. It's hard to describe the hate that they looked at us with. And I'm ashamed to say I looked back at them with some of those similar feelings. And so I prayed to keep humanity in a completely dehumanizing situation. And I think that prayer was answered.
It happened after the soldiers had cleaned piles of garbage out of an area they had just searched and were piling the garbage in a truck.
One of these detainees came running up to the fence and he was panicked, visibly shaken. And we didn't have our interpreter with us at that time of day, and the only word I could pick out was baby. As we talked to him, it became apparent that he had lost some pictures of his baby.
They started unpiling the garbage to search.
In a big way, I knew how he felt. We were halfway around the world, and all we had were pictures of our babies. A minute later, one of his friends hollered for him, and he scurried off and came back with the biggest grin you've ever seen, and he had an 8.5 by 11 picture of this beautiful Iraqi little girl in a pretty dress. The picture had been misplaced while we were searching, but he came to show us that he had it, and he beamed with pride. And again, that was an answer to me praying to find some human connection in a terrible situation.
Clayson's return home was difficult, and that's part of what propelled him into the chaplaincy, something for which Clayson says he felt a calling.
At the Last Supper, when Jesus was with his apostles and was telling them that he needed to leave, he told them that the love that they show to one another would be the signal to the world that they're his disciples. And that's exactly what I try to do with my soldiers and with everybody, is to love them like Jesus would love them if he was here.
You've been listening to Faith on the Front Lines. I'm Mark Juke, KSL News Radio.